Longpo, could you speak about the origins of Wat Pananachat, please?
How many years now? 43. I heard a rumor when I was, I think, in my eighth pansa, 8 years of bhikkhu, there was an increasing amount of Western men, hippies, and that coming to Ubon, to Wat Pohon. This was the hippie time. And so there was this, you know, this was quite a new experience for Lungpa Cha. And the Thai press was very critical of hippies. And, you know, they said they have no morals, they grow beards, and they don't take baths. So there was kind of a prejudice about hippies coming to Thailand, and they wouldn't, they made you shave off your beard in the old days. If you came, you know, to try a hippie with a beard, would they take drugs, and they're sexually promiscuous and so forth. So all the worst possible applied to hippies in the Thai press. So Ajahn Chah asked me what a hippie was. And I said, there are people that are just fed up with the way things are in America or in England, you know, they've seen the hypocrisy of the society and the futility of materialism. And he said, oh, they'd make good monks. He said, go to Bangkok and get more hippies to come. But by 1975, it's about the time, 1974-75, there were quite a few, you know, young men who were from different, from Europe, from Australia, from America, and coming to Wat Pohon and wanting to ordain. And I was the senior, you know, I was senior to them, so my duty was to translate for Lungpa Cha. And so this was onerous duty, always having to translate. And finally, Lungpa Cha, the rumor was that he was going, he had this idea of starting a branch monastery for people who come who can't speak Thai, who need to be trained by in English. And of course that was implied that he had me in mind because I was the senior foreign monk. And at first I didn't like the idea at all. I was finding it difficult to be a translator all the time, and I quite liked solitude myself, private practice, and then these people would always be full of questions. They wouldn't know anything about Buddhism. Why do you have to bow? Why do you chant in Pali language? It's dead language. Why do you have this? Why, you know, there are all these questions that you answer over and over again. And after my fifth pansa, I was so fed up with this, having to deal with these increasing amount of Westerners coming to Ubon, because before that Ubon was not a kind of tourist heaven. There's nothing, you know, people avoided Isan, and it was the poorest, most undeveloped part of Thailand. So then suddenly, you know, Lung Po Chau's fame spread to Bangkok, and there were people in Bangkok who were advising these Westerners who were looking for spiritual development to come to Ubon, to Wat Pa Pong. So after my fifth punch, I kind of ran away because I was a Majima. Getting back to that. I had to renew my passport anyway. And so it was an excuse to go to Bangkok. And then, so the sixth punch I spent at Wat Khao Chalak in Chonburi. And then, after the sixth pansa, I went on a Tudong tour of India. So I was in India with another monk. We were traveling, you know, just on alms. We didn't have a lay person, an upatak at all. Didn't know anybody in India. And I wanted to experiment to see what would happen in the country where the historical Buddha lived. You know, if you could still bindabant, you could still live as an alms mendicant in India in this modern time. So somebody offered this monk, other monk and I, a round trip flight, return flight from Bangkok to Calcutta. So we flew to Calcutta. This was in 1972. And at that time, Calcutta was an absolute hell realm because of Bangladesh. The West Pakistan broke away from East Pakistan, and there was war, and of course Calcutta is in Bengal, and there were a lot of refugees dying on the street. I saw people dying on the street, and whole families kind of living on the pavement or in the train station on the floor. To get to the train, you had to walk over people's bodies. You know, it was really shocking what I saw at that time. And I stayed at the Mahabodhi Society, a Sri Lankan Buddhist organization. And they were very welcoming, and they arranged bindabant because they had a vihara right in the middle of Calcutta, and then they arranged our bindabants. So we had very nice Sri Lankan food, Indian food, and collecting it every morning by people who were devotees of the Mahabodhi Society. But when we traveled, went to Bodh Gaya, and during this time, in the Buddhist holy sites, I had a tremendous kind of experience of gratitude to Ajahn Chah. And I had to get away, I think, to see it from a distance. And suddenly, you know, here I was in India, which is a place I always wanted to visit. And I started thinking of Lung Po Chau and all, you know, the kind of, all that he had done for me, and giving me wonderful teaching and training and everything. And then I just ran away. And I felt, you know, guilty about it. I felt ashamed. So then, and this kind of, I call it Katanyu Gadaweti, which is a Pali word for this gratitude. And, you know, so it's not just thanks for the meditation lessons kind of gratitude. It's real sense of heartfelt, like my heart opened up. Before, my meditation was very much me trying to get something. So it was, you know, it's very self-centered on me trying to get samadhi and get enlightened. And even though I appreciated Lungpo Chau and the generosity of the Thai lay people, it was more like intellectual. It was hadn't reached the heart yet. And then when I was in India, suddenly it was like, I call it a heart-opening experience. My heart kind of burst open, and I felt this really sense of where tears come down from your eyes, you know, not out of sorrow, but out of gratitude. So then I thought, I'd like to do something to repay the compassion, kindness of Lumpho Cha. What can I do? He doesn't, it's not about money or material things. And then at that time, Wangpa Pong was becoming very developed. There, he was becoming quite famous. He was well known in Bangkok, and then an increasing amount of monks. But there are always problems with monks and difficulties. And so I thought, I'll go back and offer my life to Lumpho Cha, and I'll try to be a supporting monk, not cause him any problems. So that was my Aditya. So I was in India for about 5-6 months when I returned to Wat Pa Phong. And so I'd made this kind of aditana, this vow to just follow what Lumpho Cha asked me to do, whether I wanted to do it or not. It wasn't a matter personally whether I wanted to do it or not do it. So when he asked me to establish Wat Nanacha, I didn't want to do it, but I did. So that was 1975, I think. And the reason we came here to Bungwai was because Lumpho Cha knew that the villagers, the Bungwai villagers, were very devoted to him. And he knew about this forest. This was a cremation ground for the village. And so he told us we had to fire our alms bowls. They were iron alms bowls. They weren't stainless steel then. And they get rust spots in them. And of course, in this Thai forest tradition, we were trained to fire these bowls. You have to have a lot of dry bamboo to do that. And at that time, Wat Pa Phong didn't have any dry bamboo at all, where they had a lot here in Bungwai. So we came here mainly to fire these alms bowls. But then the idea of establishing it as a forest, as a branch monastery, was in our minds also. So there were no buildings here. I don't think there was a well. I think the villagers had to dig the well that was once over there. And so first we just camped out under our umbrellas, our groats. We fired the alms bowls and the villagers asked us to stay on, and pretty soon it was getting close to entering the Pansa. So Lumpho Cha gave us permission to spend the Pansa here. So the villagers got together and built, there are about 5-6 kutis. And we had a sala that was just made of a dirt floor with bamboo benches in it. Diyangs that you sit on, and then a grass roof, not even Sangasi roof. So it was very basic, and drawing water from the well and all that. But we had about, I think that first Pantha, about 6 monks, Western monks. There was one Japanese, Ajahn Kawisako, and the rest were either Europeans or Americans, so then we realized that this would be the branch, the Furang branch monastery. So Lumpho Cha, said you have to give it a name, and he wanted to call it Wat Pa America Wat. And this was at a time when the Vietnam War was going on. And Ubon had a huge Air Force base. In fact, the Air Force, the airfield at Ubon Airport was built by the Americans during the Vietnam War. And they used to have a lot of airmen, American airmen, in Ubon and Warin. And so, you know, they were, most people just saw us as everybody's American, but there was a, you know, an increased amount of, there was a Japanese, there was an Englishman, there was several English. And so I decided that I call it Wat Ba Nana Chat, which is now known as Wat Bananas. Nana Chat means international, different nationalities. Nana is various or many, international monastery. So that's how it started. And then it was, I had only eight eight punsas, so my ninth and tenth punsas were spent here. And it was in 1975, the Americans fled Vietnam. You know, so I remember a vision, I can actually visualize the day that I was sitting in my kuti, and on the porch of my kuti, and a villager, a man from Bung Lai village, came and told me the Americans had fled Vietnam from Saigon. And I had this kind of sense of doom and a feeling, because, you know, this idea that Americans were holding the communists back, and there was this theory that once Vietnam fell to the communists, then Laos, Cambodia, then Thailand, then Malaysia, and then the Philippines, Indonesia. They called the domino theory, which was a very foolish theory, but it was the popular theory at the time. Because even in America, we were kind of told that communism is inexorable. It's, you can't stop it. It's going to take over the world, and it's up to the Americans to slow it down. And then suddenly they fled Saigon, kind of running away from the whole mess, leaving it in a total mess. And then, of course, Laos and Cambodia went communist. So during that year, you're getting these terrible reports about what's happening in Cambodia, because Cambodia is not very far from here. And, you know, about killing monks and Cambodians trying to, you know, being refugees, trying to cross the borders into Thailand for survival. And the Khmer Rouge, when they entered Phnom Penh, you know, they slaughtered about 20,000 Cambodian monks. Just outright, you know, they were the kind of Mahas, the Chao Khuns, the Sangha Raja. They impaled the Sangha Raja of Cambodia on a pole and threw his body in the lake. So it was a vicious, vicious kind of information we were receiving. And of course, Thailand at that time had a strong communist movement. And especially in Isan, in northeast Thailand, so strong that several of Lumpu Phan's monks were murdered in Sukhumvit by the communists. And so Lumpu Cha didn't want us to go Tudong in Isan anymore. He said, now there's enough branch monasteries, that you go to the branch monasteries, you know, but don't wander through, like through the Phupan Range or the jungles in northeast Thailand, because it was dangerous. So that was 1975. And there was a kind of panic throughout Thailand. The whole country went into a kind of state of panic and fear, because Thailand was considered the next one that would go. And I remember they're having meetings everywhere, and nobody knew quite what to do. And this was at the time where I began to think maybe I should, first at the time I had the idea, I hadn't been back to America for 16 years. And I had no plans to go back, but suddenly I thought maybe I should, if conditions arise, go back and try to establish something in the States. We had 22 prop rounds sitting here in this grassroots sala, and I thought, what are we going to do? Where will we go? What will happen to Ajahn Chah? So I thought maybe I'll establish a branch monastery and rescue Lumpa Cha so the communists wouldn't kill him and so forth. You know, any good ideas. And at the same time, in 1976, and when I started thinking about returning to the United States, I had this message from my father saying my mother was seriously ill. They had this swine flu epidemic at that time, and my mother was very frail anyway, and she was in intensive care in a hospital. So he wanted me to come back. So I went back to America with Warapunyo and a Thai layman. And my parents lived in San Diego, California, in Southern California. My mother became better, and so nobody seemed very interested in Theravada and Buddhist monks in San Diego. And my parents were devout Catholics, so they were glad to see me, but they weren't ready to set up a forest monastery. And then Warapunyo, he was from New York City, so we went to New York City to see his family. And I went to various Buddhist groups there, but they wanted meditation teachers. They didn't want monks. So nobody seemed very keen on inviting me to the United States. And to get back to Thailand, I had to go to London, because Thai Airways didn't go to London yet. They didn't have a flight to London. So they had a flight to London, but they didn't have a flight to America, to the west, east coast of the United States. So I flew from New York to London, and there I met this Buddhist group, English Sangha Trust, and they're the ones that invited me to England. That's why I spent the next years in the UK. But then I had, that's when the thought of establishing something abroad in a outside of Thailand was in the minds of myself and Lumpa Cha. So I left here after two Pansars, not knowing what would happen here. I'm very pleased with what happened here. I don't care, really.
You mentioned you like solitude and private practice, and I'm wondering, you spent so much of your life, you know, basically giving it to other people and being in a very public role, and I was wondering, was it, you know, when things were difficult, was it always the strength of your original vow to Lungpo Cha that kept you going? Was it you doing what you thought he would have wanted you to do, or how did you manage otherwise when you just wanted to be alone?
Well, it was, by the time I went to England, I was, I knew how to practice. I had doubts about my ability to be a monk in the UK, and, you know, the personal doubts and things like that. But I had, you know, Lumpa Cha's way of teaching was so direct that, you know, I knew how to do that, even in in a, you know, either alone or in a group or in a city. So I didn't have it, you know, I decided that it would be an experiment because Lungpa Cha thought it was good that I go to live in the UK. And so because of that, I, you know, and he had confidence in me that I would survive that, more confidence than I had in me. I trusted that. So we lived the first 2 years in London. So you're coming out of Northeast Thailand Forest Monastery in one of the world's biggest cities. You know, and it was, you know, it was challenging because we lived 2 years on a busy road in Northwest London, but in a townhouse, but I kept observing. You know, I kept, you know, I knew how to observe the way it is. It's like this, and I trusted that because I didn't, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. I was in a country I'd never lived in, you know, being a, this tradition is very strict on Vinaya, so, you know, you had that kind of training. So you had a kind of confidence in Vinaya, but you didn't, you know, how are you going to live that way in a non-Buddhist country? That was worrisome for me. But I could observe worry, you know, and doubt, states of mind that would arise. And so, you know, I never had any great problem living in the UK, keeping a Vinaya. I was there 34 years. So, I mean, my worries were here before I went there, but actually when I got there, it wasn't that difficult to live with this kind of Vinaya training. It needed explanation because we are a bit peculiar, you know, with receiving clause and things like this. The English just didn't get the point. But Ajahn Chah was always talking about the eight worldly dhammas in his talks, his formal talks. And so there's like status and no status, good fortune, misfortune, praise and blame, happiness and suffering. So, you know, he was making a point that, you know, having good fortune, being praised, being having a lot of rich supporters, everything going well with devoted lay people and very good monks and nuns and everything, that's good fortune. But if they all get up and leave you and desert you, that's misfortune. But they're of equal value. You know, I found that I liked that teaching very much, that it wasn't for me to feel I had to make it work, that it was, you know, my personality, me as a separate person, was some kind of Buddhist missionary to Europe, and I had to prove myself and spread the teaching of the Buddha, converting good Christians in England to Buddhism. I didn't have any of that kind of thoughts. And people would project a lot onto me, you know, expecting a lot from me at the time. But I trusted this awareness practice. So, and that got me through the highs and lows of living there. Because in any situation, whether you're in Thailand or in another country, you know, things are the way they are, they change. So sometimes people really supportive. Sometimes they don't like you. They spread rumors, that's the way the world changes. But in terms of Dhamma practice, it doesn't matter. So, and then we were in London 2 years. Then we acquired this property in West Sussex, Chithurst, in a little tiny hamlet near the South Downs, in a very, very beautiful part of England. And we had this old house, huge kind of 22-room derelict house to live in. And some of the local people didn't want us there. So we had to get approval from the local authorities to change the use of the place from a farm to a Buddhist monastery. And that was interesting, because it was the first time West Sussex ever had that problem. And so I kept reflecting, you know, this property, this house, is a shelter for the night. These are the four requisites. Is shelter for the night. It wasn't my house to make it permanent, you know. So on the personal level, I wanted to get proper legal status for this property, and then there were these forces working against us, and they didn't want Buddhist hippies, and they called us all kinds of names about, I don't really mind that. But then, you know, because I kept observing, you know, the thing that I minded was the possibility in the future of losing the property, because it was a really beautiful piece of land in not far from London. So we finally, everything worked out very well, and so we were successful. Well, even when we were being threatened to not be successful, I'd reflect, it's a shelter for one night rather than branch monastery of what my first branch monastery in Europe that I'm establishing. When you think like that, then, you know, that's the ego, and that's the convention. That's what people thought. But the reality is here and now, it's a shelter for the night. And this is where the four requisites are, you know, when we reflect on shelter for the night, food in the alms bowl, bungs of cooler cloth for robes, and medicine for illness. You know, these are in the standards are all low, like rag robes, fermented cow's urine for medicine. You're and a shelter for the night is a foot of a tree. And alms food, the food that people put into your alms bowl, you know, so it's the standard for the four requisites is the lowest possible standard that you can think of. It's not the best food, the best shelter, the best material for the robe, and the best medical treatments. But, you know, as samanas, we reflect that this is what we reflect on, and we always receive better than that. So I've never had to live at that, on just that low standard. But it gives you perspective on your life as a samana, because we come from, you know, places where we have higher standards of what we expect, you know, from middle class life to electricity and healthy, nourishing food, and we have all our preferential tastes and that based on high standards of material qualities. And where these four requisite reflections help you to appreciate what you do have. So I remember at Chithurst House when it was, you know, it was a mess, you know, a house that was decaying, falling down. And it smelled of dry rot, with a very unpleasant odor. And, you know, but it was, the room I had didn't leak. And so, you know, I just reflect, it's a shelter for the night. And that made me feel content, you know, because I could see the problems of being discontent, you know, worrying about the future. Would they pass us? Would they give us what we need, what we want? And what will the future happen? I could always return to Thailand, but I'd be a failure in the eyes of others. And, you know, the ego starts operating. But you're aware of the ego arises and ceases in the present. That's why I have this encouragement to don't believe what your ego says. It'll really deceive you. At least mine does. I don't know about yours. This knowing, this trust in Dhamma, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, is where, you know, you see through the ego conditioning, the Sakya Ditti, and the cultural conditioning we have. We begin to no longer just operate from this personal, separate sense of a personal entity that has to, you know, that takes things in terms of wanting the best and not wanting the worst. So what is worth, like shelter for the night, living under a tree in England, it's not a very positive option, because it's a cold country. Where in Thailand or India, you know, it's possible. And rag robes, you know. But I've always been, you know, even here at Nana Chan, as I was saying, when we first arrived here, we just had groats, these umbrellas with mosquito nets around them. I was perfectly content with that. Then for the rainy season, they had to build kutis, and they were pretty rough kutis, but they were a shelter for the night. And then you know, so you reflect that it's not personally, it's not my kuti. And you might feel that way sometimes, but then you're aware that that's just a condition arising and ceasing. So that's what I always, you know, I always encourage the Sangha to reflect on these four requisites, because they really help you to see discontentment. Because even though, you know, I can tell you should be content with the four requisites, it's like a statement, you know, of how you should feel. You know, be content with the four requisites and shut up complaining about it is one way, you know, is commanding you to be content. You can't be content at will, even though you like the idea of it. You can't just make yourself content with four requisites, but you can be aware of discontentment. And discontentment is suffering. You know, to be complaining all the time and making judgments and envying other monks and so forth, when you examine these states, they're not peaceful. And then that which is aware of them is peaceful. If you trust the awareness, then that takes you to peace, to contentment. And so the samana life is based on that, this kind of very low standard of survival. But that's where gratitude to the lay people arise, because they're always going to give you better than that. So I've lived in areas of Thailand that were really poor, where they didn't have very much material, you know, high quality things to offer, but they were always giving us the best that they could. You know, they'd give you the best food that they had, even though you may not like it. It was alms food, so it's kind of pure food, you know, food that's offered with generosity rather than pleasing the palate of Western taste buds. So then you begin to experience gatanyugatavati, contentment, and these are a very powerful stabilizing foundation for bhavana, rather than just this, and I've got to get samadhi, and I've got to, I've got to be alone in solitude, and I've got to have it like this. And you know, the ego tells you, has these ideals of an ideal monastic situation, but the ideal monastic situation is just that. You'll never find an ideal monastery. You know, they just don't exist because they're like this. They're the way they are. So you can, like in England, I keep informing them, it's like monks at Amaravati would, want to go to branch monasteries because the Amaravati's too busy and too big. And monks at Chithurst discontented with Chithurst, monks in Devon, Arnhem, because discontentment is part of our human problem. It's natural to us because we can always conceive of something better than what we have. But mindfulness is just like this. It's the way it is. And so a good monastery then is they teach the Dhamma. They respect the Vinaya. The four requisites are adequate. That's a perfect monastery. So then that simple standard leads to contentment and appreciation. So if you're at a monastery where they don't teach the Dhamma, keep the Vinaya, and they don't provide four requisites, then you should move on.